I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. In a moment, towns roiled by recent illegal immigrant raids. But first, a quick look at news from the White House today that spokesman Tony Snow's cancer has returned and that it spread to his liver. The news comes less than a week after Elizabeth Edwards, wife of presidential candidate John Edwards, announced that her breast cancer had returned in an incurable but treatable form. Joining us on the line is Richard Wolff, who covers the White House for Newsweek magazine. And Richard, we understand this is pretty emotional news. We spoke to some White House correspondents this morning seem genuinely upset to hear this news. How's the Corps reacting?
Yeah, I think people are upset. I mean, obviously there are always tensions between the White House press corps and White House staff, especially when we want to get answers to difficult questions. But there are still people at the center of this, and Tony has done a great job of showing the human side of the White House, and a lot of that is about himself. So we get to know him, we've gotten to know him, and this would be upsetting even if you didn't know him. For those of us who deal with him on a day-to-day basis, it's obviously it's a very sad piece of news.
Well, the human aspect is, of course, the most important, but then there's also the political. Remind us, Tony Snow, a Fox News commentator who also had a program, a radio program of his own, how much was he a part of helping this White House either shape policy or express it?
Well, certainly expressing it. This is a very difficult job to shape policy and be the public face because there's so much time needed in briefings, responding to reporters' phone calls. You don't get the time to sit in on long meetings and have FaceTime with the president. So I would say it's much more on the presentational side of things, and he really came in with the new chief of staff, Josh Bolton, to shake things up in what had become a very stale environment in the press briefing room with the former press secretary, Scott McClellan. So he's done a lot to shape that new atmosphere and inject a little more energy into it.
Well, this administration has had a particularly difficult relationship with the press, especially recently. So you say he's been able to maybe change that in some way?
Yes, he has, and actually really pretty much still on the White House's terms. Nobody thought or thinks that his briefings have been terribly insightful or informative, but he's done so with that TV and radio charm that he has. He's injected some humor and humanity into it, and that itself has changed the dynamic, I think, in some of these press briefings.
Well, Tony Snow's aide, Dana Perino, you know, burst into tears when she told you reporters the news this morning. He is 51 years old. His entire colon was removed in 2005. He's been very vocal about having been a cancer survivor. He underwent 6 months of chemotherapy. Now this recurrence of cancers, doctors saying that it is in his liver. Is there a sense, you know, that Tony Snow will be coming back or will be taking off to try to recover?
I don't think we can tell right now. This is a shock. He himself was downplaying the surgery that he underwent yesterday before it happened, obviously. He said he was just being super cautious. So it was shocking, and as you can tell from Dana Perino's reaction, who is his deputy and will take over his duties in terms of the press briefing, he's very much liked inside the White House among his own staff. So people are upset and sort of just taking this in, and I don't think anyone's making predictions about when or if he can come back.
It's just a reminder that cancer is nonpartisan. It doesn't care. Richard Wolff, senior White House correspondent for Newsweek magazine, thanks for the update.
Anytime.
$18,000 illegal immigrants have been arrested since the Immigration and Customs Enforcement Agency, or ICE, started Operation Return to Sender in June of 2006. Last month, more than 300 workers were arrested at the Bianco Leather Company here in New Bedford, Massachusetts. During raids at the Swift & Company slaughterhouses in six states, over 1,000 workers total were arrested. ICE has been accused of leaving children stranded, of not contacting state officials, but the agency says it's just carrying out the law. Well, today, a few minutes on the impact of these raids on communities, and we'll also speak with an Arizona congressman, a Republican, who says raids are not the answer. First, we go to San Rafael, just north of San Francisco, where federal agents raided homes on March 6th, arresting about 30 people they say had already been to court and ordered to leave the country. Juan Rodriguez is the principal of Bahia Vista Elementary School in San Rafael. Juan, what happened when these raids began?
Well, on March 6th, we were notified by many of our community members and parents that there were immigration raids that were occurring from dawn till about 8 o'clock in the morning. this is the first time that I knew about immigration actually going into people's home under the pretext of finding other people that they had search warrants for.
Well, and you say pretext, but officials there say that absolutely these were people who had been ordered out of the country. Doesn't the law have to be upheld?
Well, I'm not here to answer about the law that's being withheld. I know that the students that we service here by law are entitled to a free, appropriate, and a safe education. And the recent inhumane immigration raids have disrupted this educational process for our students and family. The kids are afraid to leave home.
You compare them to Anne Frank?
I do. The kids are being forced and the families are being forced to live in hiding and in fear. They feel outcasted. The reports that we're getting from our school psychologists and our counselors are that children are crying themselves to sleep, sleeping with backpacks on their backs. In the event that their parents are picked up in the dawn, they want to be ready to leave.
And some of them were, you know, their parents are gone, we understand, and they were left behind.
That's correct. And one incident that I know about, the mother was leaving the apartment with her seventh grader, a fourth grader, and a four-year-old. And the ICE agents picked her up and left all three kids there. The mother did not have anybody to leave the kids with, and they left the kids abandoned by themselves. This mother is now in Guatemala. The four-year-old had to be reunited with the mom a week later because this four-year-old just cried herself to sleep every single night.
What has the school been doing if kids are afraid to come out of the house because they're afraid they'll be deported or tip off where their parents are if their parents are still there? What are you doing to get kids to school?
Well, one of the things that we've done to restructure, again, the school day is that teachers have been coming in during the week and a half after the raids, have been coming in earlier, and then we provide them a list of names of students from their classrooms that have requested that they be escorted to and from the school. These are parents that have called the school and say, I'm still not comfortable, I'm afraid to leave outside, I've heard their immigration is coming back. And so rather than having kids absent and stay home and fear hiding, we actually, teachers and staff have come earlier and actually escort the kids. They pick them up at their doors, walk them to school, and walk them back home at the end of the school day.
The conflict here is that law officers will say that they're just enforcing the law, that these people were told that they had to leave the country. They'd already gone to court. We hear your concern about the kids. As a principal, how would you like it to be handled? What should have happened?
Robin, we're speaking about U.S. citizen children. To me, it's grossly unfair for those families that give so much and receive so little in return. How can we sit back and allow the children to be persecuted and outcast? And possibly in the case of the four-year-old U.S. citizen returning to Guatemala, who is being sentenced to possibly a life of poverty and ignorance. We want to return back to the business of educating our youth and making sure they're contributing to society.
Juan Rodriguez is the principal of Bahia Vista Elementary School in San Rafael. Juan, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Well, as we said, immigration agents also raided Swift & Company meatpacking plants back in December. Now, in Cactus, Texas, nearly 300 illegal immigrants were arrested. Untold number of workers fled the town of 2,500 people to avoid being arrested themselves. Jeff Jenkins is the town manager. Jeff, how did the raid affect your town?
This is kind of a remote area. In the United States, there's, you know, the population of Moore County is about 20,000. So at first, there was a scramble for the local churches and organizations to help these people out. Some of the churches in Dumas and in Cactus both helped out with food and whatever needs that were necessary. I have heard stories of babysitters taking over raising of children. I have also, you know, heard of different arrangements where the aunt or uncle or some other relative has taken children. The kids definitely are nervous. They see helicopters or anything, they tend to get a little apprehensive. And there were some people that were afraid to leave their houses. And a lot of people, not only here but everywhere in the Panhandle, was sad for their families because now they've got to pick up the pieces.
I want to get back to that, but we understand your former police chief, Tim Turley, was not as sad. In fact, he was very outspoken about how, you know, when people were saying, I'm quoting him now, oh, the poor people, they're just trying to make a living and take care of their families. He says, I don't see how a raid hurts the town because these people were using assumed identities.
Well, he represents people on that end of it, the federal laws. I mean, they definitely need to be enforced. If somebody's using someone else's identity, that definitely, I mean, that needs to be enforced. On the other hand, part of the problem is that the system right now is broken the way it is. There's no real system that, I guess you could say, you can tell exactly that somebody is illegal or legal. I mean, I believe there's about 29 different documents that can be presented to an employer, and the employer pretty much has to take it as face value, as good faith. And as long as that they have those documents, it's pretty much they can work anywhere.
What has been the impact of the deportation on businesses, rental businesses, for instance, or stores?
We have a lot of apartment units in Cactus, and their occupancy rate dropped significantly. It'll probably be some time before they have full occupancy again. The other effect is definitely on the small businesses because they dependent on some of these people to, you know, shop at their convenience stores, you know, buy just whatever for their usage.
Well, in fact, we're reading that you had a $4,000 drop in sales tax revenue, about a 30% drop from the year before. Is that big for you to have that?
We've had a drop like that before. So, I mean, is it something that we can weather through? Yeah.
Well, workers from Mexico and Guatemala have come to Cactus looking for work ever since the Swift & Company meatpacking plant opened there 35 years ago. Even your mayor, is it Luis Aguilar?
Uh-huh.
Was an illegal immigrant when he first arrived. He became a citizen during an amnesty program in the 80s. So do you have the sense that, you know, these jobs are just going to be filled again?
Well, right now, Swift & Company is doing doing recruitment throughout the United States for people. There are some incentives that are out there to entice people from Amarillo to work here. They're giving free rides to people on a daily basis. As a city, we're looking at, you know, ways to maybe improve the our housing, because we may not have exactly what people from other communities are looking for, and that's one thing we're looking at improving is our housing in general.
And it sounds like you're saying you want them to be legal.
We want to follow the laws. Yes, I mean, that's definitely what we want to do. Whatever the law is, again, we're going to follow them.
Jeff Jenkins, town manager in Cactus, Texas. In December, the meatpacking plant there was raided and 292 illegal immigrants arrested, many deported. Jeff, thank you.
You're welcome.
Well, we contacted Immigration and Customs Enforcement, or ICE, to ask them about their raid policies, particularly regarding children. ICE declined an on-air interview, but said the raids were successful law enforcement actions and that ICE officials do coordinate with state and local authorities who are responsible for ensuring the welfare of children. Well, supporters of the raids say they sent a signal to illegal immigrants, don't come. But many people are asking, is even the best raid the answer if it breaks up families and puts kids into foster care? Next, a Republican congressman from Arizona who proposes a path to citizenship with tough requirements along the way. That's ahead, here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now, and we've been talking about illegal immigration in the wake of a spate of recent raids. Immigration reform is expected to be one of the most heated battles in Congress this year. The debate proved too contentious last year, lawmakers only passing one piece of immigration legislation requiring the U.S. to build a 700-mile fence along the U.S.-Mexico border. Republican Jeff Flake of Arizona and Democrat Luis Gutierrez of Illinois introduced a new immigration reform bill in the House last week, and Congressman Flake joins us on the line with more. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Congressman, we want to get to the particulars of your bill, but first, if you would, given the conversations we just had, let's talk a little bit about the short term, the immediate need. You're aware of the recent raids, I'm sure. Hundreds of parents, in particular, detained here in New Bedford, Mass., in California, in Texas. In many cases, kids born in America and legally American left behind, schools disrupted, families torn apart. What do you think should happen in the short term, or is this just the necessary collateral damage of upholding existing laws?
Well, I think it's the latter. I just don't know how you can get away from these kind of raids if you are going to enforce the current law. And until we have a new law that takes into account the reality of the situation, you're going to see raids like these, and you're going to see an awful situation.
Well, let's take a look at your bill. It's called the Security Through Regularized Immigration and Vibrant Economy Act, or STRIVE. Just can you give us a quick outline?
Sure. Roughly half of the bill is on enforcement measures. And so we put a few triggers in the bill saying that the Department of Homeland Security needs to sign off and make sure that we're moving ahead with the Secure Border Initiative that's already underway. So those parts are there, but then also we have a mechanism to deal with those who are here illegally now and give those who can pass a background check, who have a steady job, who've committed no other crime than having crossed the border illegally, to give them some legal status here to work on a temporary basis.
And this would be after paying a fee and undergoing a background check?
That's correct. And in 6 years, if they want to adjust their status and get a green card, then there'd be a few additional requirements. They would need to do what we call touchback, where they'd have to go across a land border and make a legal entry into the country.
What would your bill do to prevent workers from forging papers if they don't want to go through these steps? We just heard, you know, about the raid in Cactus, Texas, where people who were arrested at the meatpacking plant there were found to have, you know, using the identities of, in one case, a welfare mom in California. And the town manager said companies like Swift don't have a way to ensure that their workers are legal.
I'm glad you brought that up. That's one of the most important parts of our bill. It provides for a biometric card that's machine-readable that we will phase in first with critical employees, those defense contractors and whatnot, to make sure that employers have the tools to know if those who present themselves to work are here on a legal basis. The troubling part now with the raids and whatnot, employers are in the worst position. They're forced to take a couple of forms of ID. They can't take too many. They might be sued. They have no rational basis to assume that the documents that are being presented are genuine.
Well, I understand, too, you also are looking at the future flow, as it's called, of immigrants, a guest worker program that would initially take in several hundred thousand low-skilled workers, but you could cap that according to what the market needs are. But I'm just wondering, I mean, your bill has been praised by many as an important first step in immigration reform, the Washington Post, the Boston Globe, the Arizona Daily Star. But a concern is that this bill is going to be seen as amnesty for the 12 million or so illegal immigrants living in the U.S.
Well, what we did in 1986 was an amnesty. We said if you can prove that you've been here for a period of time, then you have a shortcut to a green card. We're not doing that here. We're saying if you're here illegally and you wish to adjust your status, you have to take all these steps. But most importantly, you can't jump in line. You get no shortcut. You have to. We say that if you want to adjust your status, you can't do it until everyone who's going through the legal orderly process in their home country has a chance to move through. And that's something that we haven't had before. And then that's why I'm confident that we won't see the type of illegal flows that we have in the past.
Well, I just want to get to the criticism of the bill as well, because there has been criticism from immigrant advocates who say that, you know, one of your measures is to increase penalties on immigrants who commit crimes, that it's disproportionate punishments for minor offenses for immigrants.
Now, there are tough penalties here. There are tough penalties on employers who, after they have the tools to judge whether the documents are correct, still out the law. It goes up to, I think, $20,000 per occurrence. So there are stiff penalties on employers, and there are also stiff penalties on those who had forged documents. And so what our feeling is, if we have good legal channels for people to come here, there's no reason to go outside of them, and I think we have to have stiff penalties.
Is in part some of the penalties I'm reading that your bill would expand deportation without a hearing? Is that in part to entice hesitant lawmakers to get on board?
Oh, no. I think it's to uphold the rule of law. You have to have some stiff penalties. But like I said, if you combine that with a reasonable law that reflects the reality of our worker needs, then you can have a law that can be enforced, and the rule of law will once again reign.
And Congressman Jeff Flake, one last question. I'm wondering, you know, we started by talking to people in towns where there have been illegal immigrant raids recently, and I'm wondering if you feel that, you know, the more towns that witness the upheaval of a raid, maybe the more people are going to be likely to say there's got to be another way.
Yes, I think so. In Arizona, we've obviously felt for a while. I mean, we bear a disproportionate burden as a border state of the failure to have a rational immigration policy. And we had several years ago in the city of Chandler in my district a type of raid where they rounded up a lot of illegals, but in that net they got a lot of people who were here legally, and they're still wading through the lawsuits years later. And it caused a great deal of problems. So voices are loud for reform in Arizona, and I think they're growing all around the country.
Republican Congressman Jeff Flake of Arizona, thanks so much for speaking to us about your proposal.
Hey, thank you.
Okay, a quick look ahead. Tomorrow on Here and Now, Jan Pronk recently left his job as the UN Special Representative in Sudan, so he doesn't care who he offends in telling the truth about Darfur. That's tomorrow. Still ahead, is it possible all kids in the Texas prison system will be released because of a sex abuse scandal? That's coming up here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. More than 4,000 young people now being held in Texas juvenile prisons may soon be released because of a system-wide scandal that includes allegations of sexual abuse and corruption among prison officials and guards. The scandal may be years old, but it was first reported last month after revelations that an assistant superintendent and a principal at a youth prison in West Texas used their control of the length of a prison stay to coerce sex from inmates. Joining us is Nate Blakeslee. He's senior editor at Texas Monthly Magazine, and he broke the story in an article for the Texas Observer. Nate, welcome.
Thank you.
Let's first talk about the story in Piote, where the two officials at the West Texas State School, which is State Schools is the name for these reformer prison schools for kids, Assistant Superintendent Ray Brookings and Principal John Paul Hernandez, they were investigated by the Texas Rangers and then the FBI in 2005. But there had been complaints for years. Finally, a math tutor, according to your story, called in police. What was it that teachers saw? What was it that people were complaining about that the men were doing?
Well, Brookings was accused, as you say, for over a year of taking students off the dorms and after hours and bringing them alone into his office in the administration building and sometimes keeping them to all hours of the night. And then Hernandez, who was the principal, was accused of pulling kids out of classes and in some cases taking them off dorms after hours or even off campus after hours. And this went on for quite some time, and the question that we have now in the wake of this is, why didn't anybody come forward sooner?
Well, the math tutor did, called in the FBI, called in Texas Rangers. What did they conclude? I mean, was there any connection between Brookings and Hernandez's behavior and the length of stay in these prisons?
Well, what the Ranger found, neither of these men has been indicted, but if you read the Ranger's report, you can see where the investigation was leading. And yes, what he found was that both of these men exercised control over inmates. The principal more through his ability to give or withhold favors, but the superintendent, Assistant Superintendent Brookings, did have direct control over how long these young men had to stay in the facility and was not afraid of using that to get what he wanted from them.
And let's explain that the way these schools work is that kids can be released after 9 months, but then there's a system of phases and demerits and behavior modification that they have to reach certain standards.
That's right. They're not generally sent to these schools for a set period of time. Instead, a committee of employees at the state school, which includes the assistant superintendent, gets to decide how well the child or the young man is progressing and gets to decide what his ultimate release date can be. And if they want to, they can hold the young man until he's 21 years old.
Well, why were neither of these men prosecuted, and why didn't this, come to light sooner?
Well, the investigation wrapped up in March of 2005. I've read the report. It's extremely solid. There doesn't seem to be anything wrong with the evidence against these two men. But what happened was, all up and down the line, there seems to have been a lack of willingness on the part of state employees to do their jobs, beginning with the prosecutor, the local district attorney in Ward County, where this story takes place, has had this report on his desk now for over 2 years and has never brought it before a grand jury. And I went out there and interviewed him and asked him, why haven't you taken action on this? And the bottom line was he didn't have a good answer.
In fact, isn't it, and this sounds impossible, but is it true that one of the two men, the principal Hernandez, Then went on and got a principal job in another school.
Yes, at the time that I was reporting this story for Texas Observer, I learned that he was working at a high school in Midland, what we call a charter school, which is sort of an alternative school, and it was located in this strip mall in Midland. I went out there, walked in the door, and there he was. He was working there at that time and had been there for about 6 months.
Well, now, you know, putting the story of those two men aside, and it's being further investigated, now officials are taking a look at the whole system. What's happened since it's been revealed that abuses may be statewide?
Well, about a week after the story broke, the executive director of the entire agency resigned. The legislature happens to be in session right now in Texas, and when this story broke, they sprung into action. And in fact, this story of abuse at the Texas Youth Commission has completely hijacked the session. It's almost all they've been working on now for the last 6 weeks. They formed a special committee of the senators and representatives to investigate. They pressured the governor into asking the entire board of the agency to step down and appointing what he's calling a special master to investigate the agency from top to bottom. The special master sent police officers to all of the 13 high-security lockups in the state. They formed a special hotline to collect tips. And what we're hearing now is that so many tips and complaints are pouring in that they've opened up almost 1,000 investigations.
Well, but of those, let's be clear, of those, many seem frivolous.
Yes, a number of them they were able to easily discount, but the problem here is it's not only the new tips and allegations that they're getting. They're also going back and looking at cases that have been closed by Youth Commission investigators that maybe should not have been closed. Mm. And they're going to have to go back and look into those again and see whether those were substantiated or not. And it looks like what's going to happen is that a number of young men are going to be, and young women are going to be allowed to leave these facilities, because what they're going to find is that they were held beyond their proper length of stay.
In fact, Jay Kimbrough is the special master appointed by Governor Rick Perry, and he has just expressed how would you characterize it, what he's finding?
I think in interviews he has seemed flabbergasted to me. It's an agency that has been described as out of control. The board, it was clearly asleep at the wheel. You could see that from interviews that they and testimony and that they gave at hearings at the Capitol. They had no idea how bad the abuse was. They should have. And so now what you've got is an agency that needs to be probably restructured from top to bottom, and probably will be.
And meanwhile, we just want to note, too, that the Los Angeles Times is reporting a separate alleged scandal, an unrelated federal investigation revealing accusations of sexual abuse at a federal center for detained illegal immigrant children in South Texas. A staff member suspected of molesting children there has been fired. 72 children in the shelter moved to other locations. And now, you know, is it possible that as many as, almost 5,000, over 4,000 delinquents being held across the state in Texas may have been arbitrarily, unfairly held, you know, had their stays extended unfairly, as many as over 4,000?
Well, you're hearing that hundreds, possibly thousands, may be let go. I don't think that's going to happen overnight, but I do think what we're going to see is a gradual shrinking of the system. There seems to be consensus among everybody who's working on this that the system is much larger than it needs to be, and that the size of it is part of the problem with our apparent inability to supervise what's going on in these facilities. They're already saying they're going to close at least a couple of the big lockups and move towards a model where kids are held in smaller facilities closer to their homes.
Nate Blakeslee, senior editor at Texas Monthly Magazine, and you make that point that in many of these cases, the parents were across the state and couldn't check on the things the kids might have been telling them about problems in the schools. Nate, thanks so much for your time today.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, just a reminder, still to come before we go, three plays over 9 hours about several Russians. We'll review Tom Stoppard's new play, The Coast of Utopia, and while we're at it, we'll find out how are we supposed to say Tom Stoppard. You're listening to Here and Now. The new movie Pride smashes the old stereotype that blacks can't swim, but it's not just a fiction. The film is loosely based on the life of Jim Ellis, an African-American who created one of the nation's finest swim teams in a poor Philadelphia neighborhood. Producer Nancy Greenlease met the real Ellis a dozen years ago when she did a documentary about him, and the story proved as much a personal as professional journey.
I joined my first swim team in the early 1970s, the same time math teacher Jim Ellis started teaching black kids how to swim at a Philadelphia recreation center. My swimming world was white kids splashing in sparkling suburban pools while white coaches barked out times. I never had a black teammate until college, and that was 1984. So a decade later, when I heard about Ellis, I knew I had to check him out at a meet.
Get in the hole, in a little funk action, you understand what I'm saying? You hear me humming? See me coming. Get on that side, Earl. You got that? Get that air in and the legs.
A pudgy black man with dark pools for eyes instructed his lean black swimmer. Ellis and the swimmers from the Philadelphia Department of Recreation team, PDR for short, were the only black people at the meet. Less than a decade earlier, L.A. Dodgers general manager Al Campanis told the TV program Nightline that black people lack the buoyancy to swim. Ellis told his athletes then and now to face down such stereotypes, to strut out on the deck, sit in the prime spot, and send the competition a message.
We are here. We're not going away. You can't close your eyes and we're going to be gone when you open your eyes. We're here and we're going to stay here.
But Ellis's swimmers would often return from warm-ups to find their clothing thrown in a corner. Such acts were not uncommon. Ellis recalled a swim meet in a small Pennsylvania town.
And a couple of parents approached me in the hall and said, you know, you have basketball, you have track, you have football, you have boxing, now you want swimming. And I just kind of laughed because it didn't look like he was being vicious. It looked like he was just kind of ignorant. We're infringing upon their sport.
Ellis's swim team practices in a Philadelphia neighborhood called Nicetown, which it isn't. Drug deals go down outside. Inside, cockroaches practically have their own lane. But I watched Ellis make the chilly pool into a warm home where kids were expected to perform. In the 90s, the program was starting to make ripples. Ellis's protégés included Michael Normand, the U.S. national team's first black swimmer. But Ellis's finest work was done on land, serving as a role model for kids like then 17-year-old Damon Small.
He's the father, he's the teacher, and he's like a lieutenant general or something, because he will keep you in line. If you do something bad outside of the pool, he'll know about it. I don't know how, but he'll know about it. He keeps it straight.
What are you here for? You can't achieve excellence by not practicing. You don't want to practice. Anybody don't want to practice. Get your gear, clean your locker out, and I'll find another team for you to swim. Anybody?
No takers that day. In fact, white kids from suburbs just like mine started joining the ESTEAM program. Even with Ellis's efforts, African Americans today make up less than 2% of the sport's participants. Ellis says a lack of facilities and swimming role models are stopping kids from taking the plunge.
I mean, when you look on your TV every day and you see Shaq attack, kids want to dribble balls. But there are enough kids out here who can't do those things. And this is a sport that could do it for them.
While only a handful of Ellis's swimmers have reached the sport's highest ranks, hundreds have gone to college on swimming scholarships. Among them, Damon Small, who knew more than a dozen years ago that Ellis was giving him more than fast freestyle times.
In my job, later on in the future, I'm sure that I'll have a better chance of doing my job better than another person because I've learned patience and I've learned discipline. I think it's really an honor to be on PDR swim team.
Today, Small is a social worker. His teammates are teachers and nurses, many giving back to the community just like Jim Ellis. One PDR alumna told me that she's ready for the movie's sequel, Pride 2. She says it would be the uplifting true tale about the successful lives of these swimmers from the hood.
That's producer Nancy Greenlease. For more about the movie Pride, go to our website, here-now.org. And stay with us just ahead, a critic's view of the coast of utopia here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. That's the theme music from Tom Stoppard's The Coast of Utopia. Three plays spread over about 9 hours, playing at Lincoln Center in New York. A trilogy concerning itself with the lives and ideas of Russian philosophers and revolutionaries in the 19th century. Highly anticipated, heralded as the ticket of the season for serious theatergoers, and a complete bore, according to one prominent New York critic. Oh no, wait, another New York Times critic is in ecstasy over the piece. Well, we now turn to a third. Theater critic Ed Siegel here to give us his two cents about the three plays from Tom Stoppard. Ed, welcome.
Thank you, Robin.
And to remind us, it was Ben Brantley, ecstatic about the play. His colleague Charles Isherwood wrote the Sunday column with the now infamous headline, "Utopia is a bore, there I said it." Who's right?
Well, you know, they both are in a way, but for my money, Brantley's a lot righter.
Okay.
You know, Tom Stoppard, even at his most accessible, is never easygoing. But the reason he's one of our great playwrights is he brings these themes in his work so richly to life, whether it's the mathematics of the natural world in Arcadia or life on the Elizabethan stage in the movie he co-wrote, Shakespeare in Love.
Right, which we love. Well, and I have to say, apparently people can't even agree on how to pronounce his name. Let's get that right. I said Stoppard. You say what?
Stoppard, and okay. He's actually born in Czechoslovakia, even though he's an English playwright.
So Stoppard.
Stoppard.
Stoppard. Okay, Tom, as we're going to call him.
Right.
So he has this new work, The Coast of Utopia. What makes it worth 9 hours of your time, upwards of $300 for these coveted tickets?
This isn't the kind of play that's for everybody.
Mm-hmm.
It's not his best work. It's incredibly discursive and not as witty as a lot of his plays. So you can't blame theatergoers if 19th century Russian intellectuals aren't their cup of tea.
Well, let's hear from one of those 19th century Russian intellectuals. And also, you know, along the way, we'll find out what's to like about
mm-hmm.
it. This is actor Billy Crudup. He's the literary critic Belinsky. Set this scene up for us, Ed.
Robin, maybe one of the reasons why critics tend to like The Coast of Utopia a lot is that a critic is one of the heroes, or as close as we get to a hero in Tom's relativistic universe. Here he is, the influential progressive critic Belinsky in Part One, Voyage, arguing for Russia to take its place beside more advanced countries like France, Germany, and England.
Here things are growing not by the year but by the hour. You see what I'm saying? When the word Russia makes you think of great writers. First and foremost, the job will be done. You'll be able to walk down the streets in London or Paris, and when someone asks you where you're from, you can say, Russia! I'm from Russia, you poor bastard! So what do you think of that?
Okay, it's spirited. Your thoughts?
Well, you know, it's not Willy Loman, but what you get from it, together with the dialogue by some of Belinsky's comrades, and with the arc of the three plays, is the thrill of the intellectual ferment of the era, all the more for us living in a time that's been corrupted by talk radio and other forms of pop culture. We have the critic Belinsky, the anarchist Bakunin, the novelist Turgenev, and first and foremost the philosopher Alexander Herzen actually shaping the course of a society. Stoppard makes all this as charged as Bob Dylan going electric at Newport or the fall of the Berlin Wall.
But speaking of the Berlin Wall, as we look at our history and remember where we are in history, you could say that all of this agitation was not such a wonderful thing because we know that it eventually led to Stalin.
That's right, and that's what gives the trilogy its tragic dimension. We know, of course, something terrible is going to emerge, and the play's characters see it in the increasing hardness of younger revolutionaries who have no use for art, philosophy, or spirituality of any sort. That's why it's the coast of utopia. They never get there. There's no mm-hmm. such land, and the attempts to shape life toward utopian ideals, they don't always end well.
This is a scene from Shipwreck. Now, that's the second play. Bakunin the anarchist and Herzen the socialist,
right,
locking horns. Bakunin played by Ethan Hawke, better known as a film actor. And who plays Herzen?
That's Brian F. O'Byrne. He's an Irish-born actor who's been tearing up the New York scene in the past several years. I first saw him in Beauty Queen of Linane and then Frozen and Doubt. He's really terrific.
Let's listen.
My friends, Comrades, I give you a toast. The liberty of each for the equality of all.
The liberty of all.
Huh? What does that mean? It doesn't mean anything.
Well, I am not free unless you too are free.
That's nonsense. You were free when I was locked up. I am devoted to you, Bakunin, and I delight in the fanfare. No, the funfare of your pronouncements. You've made yourself a European reputation by a kind of revolutionary word music from which it is impossible to extract an ounce of meaning, let alone a political idea, let alone a course of action.
So very attractive theater names. We talked about Billy Crudup and there, Ethan Hawke, you know. Any women in this place, this country that doesn't exist?
Yeah, they're there, Robin. A Stoppard play without women would be like an HBO series without four-letter words. But Stoppard's aware that this is really a boys' club.
Mm.
Here Herzen is declaiming again to one of his comrades in Salvage, the final play. The one-word interruption by Martha Plimpton playing one of his lovers is telling.
She took on a married man going rapidly downhill, long-winded and expensive like you've been doing. A cheap rag, easy to smuggle, coming out once or twice a month.
Exposing abuses, naming names, yes, a popular press. What will we call it? I was waiting for you without knowing it. Herzen and Ogaryov. Together we'll dream men's dreams in newsprint.
Dream men's dreams.
Wow. Hours in a play and you get to repeat dreams, men's dreams. What would happen if you just want to see one?
If you want to sample one of them, I'd start with the second. It's far more dramatic. Just get there early enough to read the synopsis of part one, and then if you like it, you can move forward or back.
And the second one is called Shipwreck.
That's right.
Any more advice to us if we're planning to go?
Yeah, watch how much wine you have at dinner.
Especially if you're likely to snore while you sleep. Is that what you're saying?
Seriously, I wouldn't do one of these marathons where you see them all in one day. I think that's too much, but spreading them over three would be ideal. I also wouldn't wait for the trilogy to come to your local repertory company. This is a set of plays that needs the millions of dollars of stagecraft that go into it to offset the kind of declamatory nature of the dialogue. I'd bet that The Coast of Utopia won't be done nearly as well as it is in Lincoln Center for quite some time. I might be wrong, though.
Something is frozen over. A critic has said he could be wrong.
Well, you know, one thing I can say without reservation, that most playwrights today compose the theatrical equivalent of string quartets for two to four characters. Stoppard and Tony Kushner, there are two great writers of symphonies in terms of the scope of the plays as well as in the number of people in them. I would no more miss one of their works than I would if I could go back in time, miss the premiere of a Beethoven or Mahler symphony.
No, that is high praise. Ed Siegel, theater critic, weighing in on Tom Stoppard's new trilogy, The Coast of Utopia, which continues at Lincoln Center's Vivian Beaumont Theater through May 13th. Ed, thanks as always.
My pleasure, Robin.
And we leave you with Mark Bennett's music from The Coast of Utopia. Stoppard. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Join us again here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.